and thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. I'm delighted that St Edward's has undertaken to offer godly play, and I'm certain that it will be a valuable addition to the diverse and inclusive set of ministries that you already have here. But I feel especially moved by this development because it was definitely thanks to Fraser's support of my initial interest in this very unusual sounding and totally unknown approach back in the late 1990s. Thanks to that, Godly Play first took root in Cambridge when I was working as a postdoc researcher at the Faculty of Divinity. And thanks to that initial encouragement, Godly Play then began to spread a little and then more across the UK, not just into churches, but also into schools and hospitals and elderly care homes, even prisons, and even theological training, in that order. And then that's led to the very unexpected British export of Godly Play to places like Finland and Germany and Spain, Latvia, China, Belarus. The list really is too long for this talk. So it's really great to think that this will find a good home here too, back in Cambridge. I first became intrigued by Godly Play through my research on contemporary childhood spirituality. The evidence that I was able to collect and go on collecting from ordinary primary school-aged children talking about what really matters to them in their lives suggested that children typically have a very fertile, active, and profoundly relational spiritual inclination, even if they have no connection with a religious tradition as such. Working on those findings from a psychological perspective, which was my perspective, this in fact makes quite a lot of sense. Young children's ways of perceiving, of processing things, are literally cradled by their experiences of relationship, of connection and connectedness, coupled with, of course, a very lived sense of their vulnerability, a sense that their existence depends on a much larger network of reality, both seen and unseen. So that spiritual inclination is part of who they are. Indeed, psychologically, small children enjoy a long list, I think, of hallmark spiritual attributes: an attitude of openness, a readiness to make connections, a capacity to attend to physical and emotional kinds of knowing, not just mental reasoning, a respect for mystery and for what's ineffable, and an ability to be utterly absorbed, exclusively aware of the present moment, to name but just some of their attributes. And of course, poets like Blake this morning, but also Traherne and Wordsworth and others, have pointed all this out long before psychological research or childhood studies were even dreamed of. And there are also a great number of references to the validity of childhood experience and childhood spiritual insight in the Bible, which has provided a recent surge of interest in the theology of childhood, especially the sense in which childhood provides windows on really positive categories like blessing and grace and transformation and others. However, in practice, there's often been rather a pessimistic view of children's religious capacities based on their intellectual limitations in terms of logical kinds of reasoning and their inevitable lack of proper vocabulary to speak of God and the brevity of their life experience. In our own Church of England tradition, the reluctance to sometimes admit children to Holy Communion often draws on that rather pessimistic kind of view, that children shouldn't be included in that until they can properly understand it, i.e. that their capacity for spiritual encounter or insight is held back rather than aided by their childlike nature. And it also seems to go with the idea that intellectual comprehension must be necessary for meaningful spiritual encounter or engagement. Really, that's like the assumption that Jeremiah makes in this morning's reading. I'm too young. I don't know the words to speak, so I can't really have anything valid to offer. But God's arguing this is quite untrue, and that being with God, being called with God, even before our lives in the womb, that's what really matters. But we seem very easily swayed by the pessimistic view of childhood's nature, especially when it comes to approaches to the religious nurture of children. So it's quite common that practices go in for a kind of holy child-minding approach, on the grounds that if nothing much is going on spiritually for children, then whatever those children are getting up to, it doesn't much matter as long as they're safe and happy and don't disturb those of us for whom rather a lot is going on spiritually. Equally common is a practice to adopt a really earnest approach to overcome children's so-called deficits and to find ever more cunning ways to boil down essentially adults' level of religious knowledge, religious understanding, to child-sized proportions, involving telling them how this will apply to their lives once they've had more experience. So a process of informing them, telling them what things mean, so that in the long run, when they have experiences, this might make sense. And so in practice, that's a ministry of child instruction. And in more recent times, often that's done in the guise of religious child-friendly infotainment. But what if the poets, the biblical suggestions, and the recent empirical studies of childhood spirituality are right? What if, in fact, children are not spiritually empty vessels that we first need to fill up in order to have any hope of igniting spiritual life, any awareness of God? What if childhood is not a depressingly, spiritually dormant non-time, a kind of limbo? What if, in fact, every child is able to experience the presence of the mystery of God, and that the many qualities of being like a child are particularly helpful for people of every age to experience God, as in fact Jesus himself argued, suggesting that maturity might lie in becoming more like a child, not recovering from being like a child. And this is where godly play comes in, and what first attracted my interest to its potential. The premise for all the practices associated with godly play is precisely that every child has experience of the presence of the mystery of God, that every child has their own ways of knowing God, even when they may as yet know little about God. And that really changes the tasks of practical ministry with children to being about helping children to discover the ways that the languages of the Christian tradition can do justice to their existing and deep and emerging capacity for numinous experiences. But in godly play, the task is not just to deposit religious knowledge and language into the child's spiritual bank account, but rather to really demonstrate and teach the art of using Christian language as they go along, as they make meaning with their lives here and now. As Jerome Berryman, the educationalist and theologian who's done the most to develop godly play, recently stated, the goal is really that children become artists of the Christian life. Children become artists of the Christian life, learning this art by hands-on use of the media, the languages of our tradition, its words, its stories, its gestures, its actions, its images and symbols, and its language of space and silence, and learning that for themselves in creative and meaning-making ways. So the process of godly play is a lot closer to spiritual direction or spiritual guidance than it is religious education or religious instruction. And that's a claim which I hope you can test for yourself if you can stay for the short example of godly play that will be offered at the end of this service. But what happens when things are shaped around this different way of thinking about children and perhaps a different way of thinking about Christian life? And where does play come into it all? Well, I thought some illustrations might be the most effective way of glimpsing how much difference this can make, both from the child's point of view, but perhaps also to our adult appreciation of children's spirituality and the ways in which our spirituality as adults could become properly childlike. A typical godly play session keeps to a familiar timetable and in an equally consistent, well-prepared space. The patterning of time spent together is intentionally like the shape of the Eucharist. So there's a time of welcome, of gathering and preparation, then a time to hear the word together and to see it as well, told in a story form. And then a time of gently guided reflection or wondering about that experience of the story together. And then that leads into a period of more private, individual, freely chosen response time. For example, perhaps playing with the story to explore it further, or drawing or painting, not necessarily in a representational way, but perhaps as a vehicle of concentration and contemplation for the child, or they may choose to read or write depending on their age. And after that time of personal reflection, the group comes back together in a circle to enjoy what's termed a feast, more because of how it's shared together and how it's treated as a significant thing than for its calorific content. And finally, time is devoted to ending properly, acknowledging the mutual blessings of that time spent together and the way that we might journey onward beyond that time. Now, everyone, including the adult guide of all this, sits together on the floor in a circle for most of the time, except for that personal time. And that signals, amongst other things, a kind of equality before God, that we're all involved in a shared spiritual journey, if you like. And the space around, the room around that circle, is specially arranged too, to suggest things like the coherence, the beauty, the accessibility, and the mystery of Christian language, and of course, of God. Trays or baskets of thoughtfully carved and simple figures and images, each telling a particular part of the Christian story, offer, if you like, a visual timeline of Bible history, also offer a visual sense of the different genres of biblical material and of the categories and seasons of church practice. And all this is set out at child level, making absolutely clear this is for you. It's good to come close to this, to become familiar with this, to find out what it could be for you. In telling the story for that day, the adult uses carefully researched and scripted, prayerfully learnt words, and uses those beautifully carved images and figures. And the storyteller tries to be as much aware of her words as she is of her gestures and her use of silence. Since not only are children phenomenally precocious readers of those non-verbal languages of gesture and silence and image, but of course they're also the languages that are integral to the Christian tradition to communicate our experience of God. All of these are the media for real artists of the Christian life. So how do children actually respond to all this? Well, certainly I see very, very often a visceral kind of response to being invited into such an intentionally arranged space and time. Children seem to relax, become really absorbed, and often deeply creative. They immediately pick up the sense that this is not just holy child-minding, a place that they've been sort of put away to. Noisy children, attention-seeking children perhaps, calm down. And the reticent children often really find a voice. I think for many children, particularly in the society of today, the busyness of today for children, all of this serves as a sanctuary on many levels. In fact, in one church where I was doing this, the children explained what godly play meant for them, saying, "This means that church is the place where we can rest and just be ourselves," which seemed to me was a more authentic understanding and practice of Sabbath and of church than I'd had in a long time. So I often dwell on those words about a place to just rest and be oneself. Children also respond especially to the absence of any predetermined agenda or learning outcomes for each session. There's a great openness in godly play, despite that bounded sense of time and space. And this is both in the way the stories are told and in the deliberately open-ended wondering or reflection. And children's spirituality seems to really thrive on that signal that you're invited, you're allowed, you're meant to play with this, and you're allowed to become more aware of your own authentic response as a fuel for making meaning, rather than always depending on sort of second-hand meanings you're told about or you have to guess from what's inside the teacher's head. This has a lot more in common with Lectio Divina. And so frequently the Spirit speaks in profound and fresh ways to children and through those children to adults as well. So just a couple of examples of that before I stop. For example, one Sunday, the group of children had had the story of the Holy Family, which is essentially just a simple narrative about Jesus' birth using plain wooden figures that you'd probably see in a nativity set. In their wondering together about this story, the children were invited to say which character in the nativity they liked the best, and then which character seemed the most important to them, and even whether any of these characters reminded them of things that they'd seen in their church. And the conversation, as usual, was as wide-ranging as it was personal. For example, many children find the weirdness of the Holy Family really resonates with their own lives, comprising of a birth mother and a stepfather, perhaps, or people who seem to drop into your family from the other side of the world, people you hardly know. And also having relatives that seem to represent opposing ends of the social ladder. They connect in all kinds of personal ways with the images in that nativity scene. But on this particular Sunday, towards the end, the adult guide asked the children, a little playfully, if they thought any of the characters could actually be left out, implicitly asking the children to discern what really, really matters here then. Initially, the apparently peripheral figures were suggested and removed to see what effect their absence had on the whole scene. So perhaps we could do with one less sheep, was suggested. Maybe we could have two wise men instead of three. Perhaps Mary could have coped without Joseph. And all of those wonderings and playing around with the story did help the children to peer deeper into their initial responses as the scene got rearranged many, many times, playing out the ideas the children suggested. And so eventually every figure, except of course the Christ child, had been talked about as, well, we could try removing that one. Then though, a seven-year-old girl, sounding rather fed up, provocatively said, "Oh, go on then, take him out," pointing at the baby. Well, the adult carefully picked up the baby and closed him in her hand and looked back at the girl, who for a moment was just a bit shocked that her subversive and playful and fed-up suggestion had been taken actually seriously. But then she said, "Well, I suppose that's okay. Now they won't just all stare down at the baby, and they'll begin to see each other. Because I think that's where you find Jesus these days, not in the baby, but in all the different people there are, looking right into their faces." Being permitted, being encouraged to play with that familiar story, to move it around, literally and metaphorically, gave that little girl's spiritual capacity and spiritual insight a genuine means of expression in that moment. But sometimes the artistry of children using Christian language can be even more playful and opaque. Much of it goes on below the radar, perhaps, when they're playing by themselves in that time of personal response, or just at any time, or even in the in-between times. For example, in one session, the time had come to carefully put back on the shelves all the bits of the stories, the figures that the children had chosen to play with that day, and a tidy-up time to clear away any other things they'd been using, crayons and paper and so on. And once all of that clearing up's done, everyone sits down again in the circle for the feast, usually of grapes or a biscuit. In the melee of tidying up that time, the adult guide was horrified to see 5-year-old Ryan's approach to tidying up. He'd been playing with the story of the Good Shepherd and the sheep, but instead of carefully putting everything neatly back in the basket, he was deliberately ripping up the figures, which had been specially painted but just made out of cardboard, but they'd been specially made for that godly playroom. And it seemed to this adult wanton destruction and selfishness, as if to say, well, I've finished with them, so they can just be thrown away, with no thought for any subsequent child who might like to play with that story on another occasion. So the adult resolved to have a very serious chat with Ryan afterwards about his behaviour. But as the children sat down in their circle, one of the little girls brought back round a bowl of raisins for all the children to share, followed by another adult with a tray of drinks, so each child would have something to eat and something to drink. But then 5-year-old Ryan nipped in front of both of these servers of the feast and went to every child in the circle and gave them each a small piece of the broken Good Shepherd, saying just two words, for you, for you, for you. I hope these stories illustrate not just something of the profundity of children's spirituality, especially when given the conditions in which it can really thrive, but perhaps also these suggest something of how children's spirituality can be a source of blessing or a glimpse of grace in our adult spiritual lives too. And I really pray that a spirit of playfulness and the unlimited artistic possibilities of Christian language will dance between what happens in your new godly playroom and all the other parts of life at St. Edward's.
Next week we'll be doing Godly Play twice a month, usually on the first and third Sundays. Actually this month I'm usually the first and fourth Sundays, because the third Sundays are special, and that's a fun occasion for the children to join in anyway. All this is on the monthly newsletter for September, the yellow one that you might have picked up on the way in, but if not, do pick it up on the way out. Could we read in my prayers now with the child failing some? I'll sing this the first time, then we'll sing it all together and another four times. Ourselves. We know our strengths and our weaknesses better than we